This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. Read by James Simmons. Preface. When Mr. Ashley Sampson suggested to me the writing of this book, I asked leave to be allowed to write it anonymously, since, if I were to say what I really thought about pain, I should be forced to make statements of such apparent fortitude that they would become ridiculous if anyone knew who made them. Anonymity was rejected as inconsistent with the series, but Mr. Sampson pointed out that I could write a preface explaining that I did not live up to my own principles. This exhilarating program I am now carrying out. Let me confess at once, in the words of good Walter Hilton, that throughout this book I feel myself so far from true feeling of that I speak that I can naught else but cry mercy and desire after it as I may. Yet for that very reason, there is one criticism which cannot be brought against me. No one can say, "He jests at scars who never felt a wound," for I have never for one moment been in a state of mind to which even the imagination of serious pain was less than intolerable. If any man is safe from the danger of underestimating this adversary, I am that man. I must add, too, that the only purpose of the book is to solve the intellectual problem raised by suffering. For the far higher task of teaching fortitude and patience, I was never fool enough to suppose myself qualified, nor have I anything to offer my readers except my conviction that when pain is to be borne, a little courage helps more than much knowledge, a little human sympathy more than much courage, and the least tincture of the love of God more than all. If any real theologian reads these pages, he will very easily see that they are the work of a layman and an amateur. Except in the last two chapters, parts of which are admittedly speculative, I have believed myself to be restating ancient and orthodox doctrines. If any parts of the book are original, in the sense of being novel or unorthodox, they are so against my will and as a result of my ignorance. I write, of course, as a layman of the Church of England, but I have tried to assume nothing that is not professed by all baptized and communicating Christians. As this is not a work of erudition, I have taken little pains to trace ideas or quotations to their sources when they were not easily recoverable. Any theologian will see easily enough what and how little I have read. C.S. Lewis, Magdalen College, Oxford, 1940. 1. Introductory. I wonder at the hardihood with which such persons undertake to talk about God. In a treatise addressed to infidels, they begin with a chapter proving the existence of God from the works of nature. This only gives their readers grounds for thinking that the proofs of our religion are very weak. It is a remarkable fact that no canonical writer has ever used nature to prove God. Pascal, Pensée. 4.242-243. Not many years ago, when I was an atheist, if anyone had asked me, "Why do you not believe in God?" my reply would have run something like this. Look at the universe we live in. By far the greatest part of it consists of empty space, completely dark and unimaginably cold. The bodies which move in this space are so few and so small in comparison with the space itself that even if every one of them were known to be crowded as full as it could hold with perfectly happy creatures, it would still be difficult to believe that life and happiness were more than a byproduct to the power that made the universe. As it is, however, the scientists think it likely that very few of the suns of space, perhaps none of them except our own, have any planets, and in our own system it is improbable that any planet except the Earth sustains life, and Earth herself existed without life for millions of years and may exist for millions more when life has left her. And what is it like while it lasts? It is so arranged that all the forms of it can live only by preying upon one another. In the lower forms, this process entails only death, but in the higher there appears a new quality called consciousness, which enables it to be attended with pain. The creatures cause pain by being born, and live by inflicting pain, and in pain they mostly die. In the most complex of all the creatures, man, yet another quality appears, which we call reason, whereby he is enabled to foresee his own pain, which henceforth is preceded with acute mental suffering, and to foresee his own death while keenly desiring permanence. It also enables men, by 100 ingenious contrivances, to inflict a great deal more pain than they otherwise could have done on one another and on the irrational creatures. This power they have exploited to the full. Their history is largely a record of crime, war, disease, and terror, with just sufficient happiness interposed to give them, while it lasts, an agonized apprehension of losing it, and when it is lost, the poignant misery of remembering. Every now and then, they improve their condition a little, and what we call a civilization appears. But all civilizations pass away, and even while they remain, inflict peculiar sufferings of their own, probably sufficient to outweigh what alleviations they may have brought to the normal pains of man. That our own civilization has done so, no one will dispute. That it will pass away like all its predecessors is surely probable. Even if it should not, what then? The race is doomed. Every race that comes into being in any part of the universe is doomed, for the universe, they tell us, is running down, and will sometime be a uniform infinity of homogeneous matter at a low temperature. All stories will come to nothing. All life will turn out in the end to have been a transitory and senseless contortion upon the idiotic face of infinite matter. If you ask me to believe that this is the work of a benevolent and omnipotent spirit, I reply that all the evidence points in the opposite direction. Either there is no spirit behind the universe, or else a spirit indifferent to good and evil, or else an evil spirit. There was one question which I never dreamed of raising. I never noticed that the very strength and facility of the pessimist's case at once poses us a problem. If the universe is so bad, or even half so bad, how on earth did human beings ever come to attribute it to the activity of a wise and good creator? Men are fools, perhaps, but hardly so foolish as that. The direct inference from black to white, from evil flower to virtuous root, from senseless work to a workman infinitely wise, staggers belief. The spectacle of the universe, as revealed by experience, can never have been the ground of religion. It must always have been something in spite of which religion, acquired from a different source, was held. It would be an error to reply that our ancestors were ignorant and therefore entertained pleasing illusions about nature which the progress of science has since dispelled. For centuries, during which all men believed, the nightmare size and emptiness of the universe was already known. You will read in some books that the men of the Middle Ages thought the earth flat and the stars near. But that is a lie. Ptolemy had told them that the earth was a mathematical point without size in relation to the distance of the fixed stars, a distance which one medieval popular text estimates as 117 million miles. And in times yet earlier, even from the beginnings, men must have got the same sense of hostile immensity from a more obvious source. To prehistoric man, the neighbouring forest must have been infinite enough. And the utterly alien and infest which we have to fetch from the thought of cosmic rays and cooling suns came snuffing and howling nightly to his very doors. Certainly at all periods, the pain and waste of human life was equally obvious. Our own religion begins among the Jews, a people squeezed between great warlike empires, continually defeated and led captive, familiar as Poland or Armenia with the tragic story of the conquered. It is mere nonsense to put pain among the discoveries of science. Lay down this book and reflect for 5 minutes on the fact that all the great religions were first preached and long practiced in a world without chloroform. At all times, then, an inference from the course of events in this world to the goodness and wisdom of the Creator would have been equally preposterous, and it was never made. Religion has a different origin. In what follows, it must be understood that I am not primarily arguing the truth of Christianity, but describing its origin. A task, in my view, necessary if we are to put the problem of pain in its right setting. In all developed religion, we find three strands or elements, and in Christianity, one more. The first of these is what Professor Otto calls the experience of the numinous. Those who have not met this term may be introduced to it by the following device. Suppose you were told there was a tiger in the next room. You would know that you were in danger, and you would probably feel fear. But if you were told there is a ghost in the next room, and believed it, you would feel indeed what is often called fear, but of a different kind. It would not be based on the knowledge of danger, for no one is primarily afraid of what a ghost may do to him, but of the mere fact that it is a ghost. It is uncanny rather than dangerous, and the special kind of fear it excites may be called dread. With the uncanny, one has reached the fringes of the numinous. Now, suppose that you were told simply, there is a mighty spirit in the room, and believed it. Your feelings would then be even less like the mere fear of danger, but the disturbance would be profound. You would feel wonder and a certain shrinking, a sense of inadequacy to cope with such a visitant and of prostration before it, an emotion which might be expressed in Shakespeare's words, "Under it my genius is rebuked." This feeling may be described as awe, and the object which excites it as the numinous. Now, nothing is more certain than that man, from a very early period, began to believe that the universe was haunted by spirits. Professor Otto, perhaps, assumes too easily that from the very first such spirits were regarded with numinous awe. This is impossible to prove for the very good reason that utterances expressing awe of the numinous and utterances expressing mere fear of danger may use identical language, as we can still say that we are afraid of a ghost or afraid of a rise in prices. It is therefore theoretically possible that there was a time when men regarded these spirits simply as dangerous and felt towards them just as they felt towards tigers. What is certain is that now, at any rate, the numinous experience exists, and that if we start from ourselves, we can trace it a long way back. A modern example may be found, if we are not too proud to see it there, in The Wind in the Willows, where Rat and Mole approach Pan on the island. "Rat," he found breath to whisper, shaking, "are you afraid?" "Afraid," murmured the Rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. "Afraid? Of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, oh, Mole, I am afraid." Going back about a century, we find copious examples in Wordsworth, perhaps the finest being that passage in the first book of the Prelude, where he describes his experience while rowing on the lake in the stolen boat. Going back further, we get a very pure and strong example in Malory, when Galahad began to tremble right hard when the deadly, that is mortal, flesh began to behold the spiritual things. At the beginning of our era, it finds expression in the Apocalypse, where the writer fell at the feet of the risen Christ as one dead. In pagan literature, we find Ovid's picture of the dark grove on the Aventine, of which you would say at a glance, "Numen inest," the place is haunted, or there is a presence here. And Virgil gives us the palace of Latinus, awful, horrendum, with woods and sanctity, religione, of elder days. A Greek fragment, attributed but improbably to Aeschylus, tells us of earth, sea, and mountains shaking beneath the dread eye of their master. And far further back, Ezekiel tells us of the rings in his theophany, that they were so high that they were dreadful. And Jacob, rising from sleep, says, "How dreadful is this place!" We do not know how far back in human history this feeling goes. The earliest men almost certainly believed in things which would excite the feeling in us if we believed in them, and it seemed therefore probable that numinous awe is as old as humanity itself. But our main concern is not with its dates. The important thing is that somehow or other it has come into existence, and is widespread, and does not disappear from the mind with the growth of knowledge and civilization. Now this awe is not the result of an inference from the visible universe. There is no possibility of arguing from mere danger to the uncanny, still less to the fully numinous. You may say that it seems to you very natural that early man, being surrounded by real dangers, and therefore frightened, should invent the uncanny and the numinous. In a sense it is. But let us understand what we mean. You feel it to be natural because, sharing human nature with your remote ancestors, you can imagine yourself reacting to perilous solitudes in the same way. And this reaction is indeed natural, in the sense of being in accord with human nature. But it is not in the least natural, in the sense that the idea of the uncanny or the numinous is already contained in the idea of the dangerous, or that any perception of danger or any dislike of the wounds and death which it may entail could give the slightest conception of ghostly dread or numinous awe to an intelligence which did not already understand them. When man passes from physical fear to dread and awe, he makes a sheer jump and apprehends something which could never be given, as danger is, by the physical facts and logical deductions from them. Most attempts to explain the numinous presuppose the thing to be explained, as when anthropologists derive it from the fear of the dead, without explaining why dead men, assuredly the least dangerous kind of men, should have attracted this peculiar feeling. Against all such attempts, we must insist that dread and awe are in a different dimension from fear. They are in the nature of an interpretation man gives to the universe, or an impression he gets from it. And just as no enumeration of the physical qualities of a beautiful object could ever include its beauty, or give the faintest hint of what we mean by beauty to a creature without aesthetic experience, so no factual description of any human environment could include the uncanny and the numinous, or even hint at them. There seem, in fact, to be only two views we can hold about awe. Either it is a mere twist in the human mind, corresponding to nothing objective and serving no biological function, yet showing no tendency to disappear from that mind at its fullest development in poet, philosopher, or saint, or else it is a direct experience of the really supernatural, to which the name revelation might properly be given. The numinous is not the same as the morally good, and a man overwhelmed with awe is likely, if left to himself, to think the numinous object beyond good and evil. This brings us to the second strand, or element, in religion. All the human beings that history has heard of acknowledge some kind of morality. That is, they feel towards certain proposed actions the experiences expressed by the words "I ought" or "I ought not." These experiences resemble awe in one respect, namely that they cannot be logically deduced from the environment and physical experiences of the man who undergoes them. You can shuffle "I want" and "I am forced" and "I shall be well advised" and "I dare not" as long as you please, without getting out of them the slightest hint of "ought" and "ought not." And once again, attempts to resolve the moral experience into something else always presuppose the very thing that they are trying to explain, as when a famous psychoanalyst deduces it from prehistoric parricide. If the parricide produced a sense of guilt, that was because men felt that they ought not to have committed it. If they did not so feel, it could produce no sense of guilt. Morality, like numinous awe, is a jump. In it, man goes beyond anything that can be given in the facts of experience. And it has one characteristic too remarkable to be ignored. The moralities accepted among men may differ, though not, at bottom, so widely as is often claimed. But they all agree in prescribing a behaviour which their adherents fail to practice. All men alike stand condemned, not by alien codes of ethics, but by their own, and all men, therefore, are conscious of guilt. The second element in religion is the consciousness not merely of a moral law, but of a moral law at once approved and disobeyed. This consciousness is neither a logical nor an illogical inference from the facts of experience. If we did not bring it to our experience, we could not find it there. It is either inexplicable illusion or else revelation. The moral experience and the numinous experience are so far from being the same that they may exist for quite long periods without establishing a mutual contact. In many forms of paganism, the worship of the gods and the ethical discussions of the philosophers have very little to do with each other. The third stage in religious development arises when men identify them, when the numinous power, to which they feel awe, is made the guardian of the morality to which they feel obligation. Once again, this may seem to you very natural. What can be more natural than for a savage, haunted at once by awe and by guilt, to think that the power which awes him is also the authority which condemns his guilt? And it is indeed natural to humanity. But it is not in the least obvious. The actual behaviour of that universe, which the numinous haunts, bears no resemblance to the behaviour which morality demands of us. The one seems wasteful, ruthless, and unjust. The other enjoins upon us the opposite qualities. Nor can the identification of the two be explained as a wish fulfillment, for it fulfills no one's wishes. We desire nothing less than to see that law, whose naked authority is already unsupportable, armed with the incalculable claims of the numinous. Of all the jumps that humanity takes in its religious history, this is certainly the most surprising. It is not unnatural that many sections of the human race refused it. Non-moral religion and non-religious morality existed and still exist. Perhaps only a single people, as a people, took the new step with perfect decision. I mean the Jews. But great individuals in all times and places have taken it also. And only those who take it are safe from the obscenities and barbarities of the unmoralized worship, or the cold, sad self-righteousness of sheer moralism. Judged by its fruits, This step is a step towards increased health. And though logic does not compel us to take it, it is very hard to resist. Even on paganism and pantheism, morality is always breaking in, and even Stoicism finds itself willy-nilly bowing the knee to God. Once more, it may be madness, a madness congenital to man and oddly fortunate in its results, or it may be revelation. And if revelation, then it is most really and truly in Abraham that all people shall be blessed. For it was the Jews who fully and unambiguously identified the awful presence, haunting black mountaintops and thunderclouds, with the righteous Lord who loveth righteousness. The fourth strand, or element, is a historical event. There was a man born among these Jews who claimed to be, or to be the son of, or to be one with, the something which is at once the awful haunter of nature and the giver of the moral law. This claim is so shocking, a paradox and even a horror, which we may easily be lulled into taking too lightly, that only two views of this man are possible. Either he was a raving lunatic of an unusually abominable type, or else he was, and is, precisely what he said. There is no middle way. If the records make the first hypothesis unacceptable, you must submit to the second. And if you do that, all else that is claimed by Christians becomes credible, that this man, having been killed, was yet alive, and that his death, in some manner incomprehensible to human thought, has effected a real change in our relations to the awful and righteous Lord, and a change in our favour. To ask whether the universe as we see it looks more like the work of a wise and good creator, or the work of chance, indifference, or malevolence, is to omit from the outset all the relevant factors in the religious problem. Christianity is not the conclusion of a philosophical debate on the origins of the universe. It is a catastrophic historical event following on the long spiritual preparation of humanity which I have described. It is not a system into which we have to fit the awkward fact of pain. It is itself one of the awkward facts which have to be fitted into any system we make. In a sense, it creates rather than solves the problem of pain. For pain would be no problem unless, side by side with our daily experience of this painful world, we had received what we think a good assurance that ultimate reality is righteous and loving. Why this assurance seems to me good, I have more or less indicated. It does not amount to logical compulsion. At every stage of religious development, man may rebel, if not without violence to his own nature, yet without absurdity. He can close his spiritual eyes against the numinous, if he is prepared to part company with half the great poets and prophets of his race, with his own childhood, with the richness and depth of uninhibited experience. He can regard the moral law as an illusion, and so cut himself off from the common ground of humanity. He can refuse to identify the numinous with the righteous, and remain a barbarian, worshipping sexuality, or the dead, or the life force, or the future. But the cost is heavy. And when we come to the last step of all, the historical incarnation, the assurance is strongest of all. The story is strangely like many myths which have haunted religion from the first, and yet it is not like them. It is not transparent to the reason. We could not have invented it ourselves. It has not the suspicious a priori lucidity of pantheism or of Newtonian physics. It has the seemingly arbitrary and idiosyncratic character which modern science is slowly teaching us to put up with in this willful universe, where energy is made up in little parcels of a quantity no one could predict, where speed is not unlimited, where irreversible entropy gives time a real direction, and the cosmos, no longer static or cyclic, moves like a drama from a real beginning to a real end. If any message from the core of reality ever were to reach us, we should expect to find in it just that unexpectedness, that willful, dramatic anfractuosity which we find in the Christian faith. It has the master touch, the rough, male taste of reality, not made by us, or indeed for us, but hitting us in the face. If on such grounds, or on better ones, we follow the course on which humanity has been led and become Christians, we then have the problem of pain. 2. Divine omnipotence. Nothing which implies contradiction falls under the omnipotence of God. Thomas Aquinas. If God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy, and if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. but the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. This is the problem of pain in its simplest form. The possibility of answering it depends on showing that the terms good and almighty, and perhaps also the term happy, are equivocal. For it must be admitted from the outset that if the popular meanings attached to these words are the best or the only possible meanings, then the argument is unanswerable. In this chapter, I shall make some comments on the idea of omnipotence, and in the following, some on the idea of goodness. Omnipotence means power to do all, or everything, and we are told in Scripture that with God all things are possible. It is common enough in argument with an unbeliever to be told that God, if he existed and were good, would do this or that. And then, if we point out that the proposed action is impossible, to be met with the retort, "But I thought God was supposed to be able to do anything." This raises the whole question of impossibility. In ordinary usage, the word impossible generally implies a suppressed clause beginning with the word unless. Thus, it is impossible for me to see the street from where I sit writing at this moment. That is, it is impossible to see the street unless I go up to the top floor where I shall be high enough to overlook the intervening building. If I had broken my leg, I should say, "But it is impossible to go up to the top floor," meaning, however, that it is impossible unless some friends turn up who will carry me. Now, let us advance to a different plane of impossibility by saying, it is at any rate impossible to see the street so long as I remain where I am and the intervening building remains where it is. Someone might add, unless the nature of space or of vision were different from what it is. I do not know what the best philosophers and scientists would say to this, but I should have to reply, I don't know whether space and vision could possibly have been of such a nature as you suggest. Now, it is clear that the words could possibly here refer to some absolute kind of possibility or impossibility, which is different from the relative possibilities and impossibilities we have been considering. I cannot say whether seeing round corners is, in this new sense, possible or not, because I do not know whether it is self-contradictory or not. But I know very well that if it is self-contradictory, it is absolutely impossible. The absolutely impossible may also be called the intrinsically impossible, because it carries its impossibility within itself. Instead of borrowing it from the other impossibilities, which in their turn depend upon others, it has no unless clause attached to it. It is impossible under all conditions and in all worlds and for all agents. All agents here includes God himself. His omnipotence means power to do all that is intrinsically possible, not to do the intrinsically impossible. You may attribute miracles to him, but not nonsense. This is no limit to his power. If you choose to say God can give a creature free will and at the same time withhold free will from it, you have not succeeded in saying anything about God. Meaningless combinations of words do not suddenly acquire meaning simply because we prefix to them the two other words God can. It remains true that all things are possible with God. The intrinsic impossibilities are not things, but non-entities. It is no more possible for God than for the weakest of his creatures to carry out both of two mutually exclusive alternatives, not because his power meets an obstacle, but because nonsense remains nonsense even when we talk it about God. It should, however, be remembered that human reasoners often make mistakes, either by arguing from false data or by inadvertence in the argument itself. We may thus come to think things possible which are really impossible, and vice versa. We ought, therefore, to use great caution in defining those intrinsic impossibilities which even omnipotence cannot perform. What follows is to be regarded less as an assertion of what they are than a sample of what they might be like. The inexorable laws of nature, which operate in defiance of human suffering or desert, which are not turned aside by prayer, seem at first to furnish a strong argument against the goodness and power of God. I am going to submit that not even omnipotence could create a society of free souls without at the same time creating a relatively independent and inexorable nature. There is no reason to suppose that self-consciousness, the recognition of a creature by itself as a self, can exist except in contrast with another, a something which is not the self. It is against an environment, and preferably a social environment, an environment of other selves, that the awareness of myself stands out. This would raise a difficulty about the consciousness of God if we were mere theists. Being Christians, we learn from the doctrine of the Blessed Trinity that something analogous to society exists within the divine being from all eternity. That God is love, not merely in the sense of being the Platonic form of love, but because within him the concrete reciprocities of love exist before all worlds and are thence derived to the creatures. Again, the freedom of a creature must mean freedom to choose, and choice implies the existence of things to choose between. A creature with no environment would have no choices to make. So that freedom, like self-consciousness, if they are not indeed the same thing, again demands the presence, to the self, of something other than the self. The minimum condition of self-consciousness and freedom, then, would be that the creature should apprehend God, and therefore itself as distinct from God. It is possible that such creatures exist, aware of God and themselves, but of no fellow creatures. If so, their freedom is simply that of making a single naked choice, of loving God more than the self, or the self more than God. But a life so reduced to essentials is not imaginable to us. As soon as we attempt to introduce the mutual knowledge of fellow creatures, we run up against the necessity of nature. People often talk as if nothing were easier than for two naked minds to meet or become aware of each other. But I see no possibility of their doing so except in a common medium, which forms their external world or environment. Even our vague attempt to imagine such a meeting between disembodied spirits usually slips in surreptitiously the idea of at least a common space and common time to give the co in coexistence a meaning. And space and time are already an environment. But more than this is required. If your thoughts and passions were directly present to me, like my own, without any mark of externality or otherness, how should I distinguish them from mine? And what thoughts or passions could we begin to have without objects to think and feel about? Nay, could I even begin to have the conception of external and other, unless I had experience of an external world? You may reply, as a Christian, that God and Satan do in fact affect my consciousness in this direct way, without signs of externality. Yes, and the result is that most people remain ignorant of the existence of both. We may therefore suppose that if human souls affected one another directly and immaterially, it would be a rare triumph of faith and insight for any one of them to believe in the existence of the others. It would be harder for me to know my neighbour under such conditions than it is now for me to know God, for in recognising the impact of God upon me, I am now helped by things that reach me through the external world, such as the tradition of the Church, Holy Scripture, and the conversation of religious friends. What we need for human society is exactly what we have, a neutral something, neither you nor I, which we can both manipulate so as to make signs to each other. I can talk to you because we can both set up sound waves in the common air between us. Matter, which keeps souls apart, also brings them together. It enables each of us to have an outside as well as an inside, so that what are acts of will and thought for you are noises and glances for me. You are enabled not only to be, but to appear, and hence I have the pleasure of making your acquaintance. Society, then, implies a common field or world in which its members meet. If there is an angelic society, as Christians have usually believed, then the angels also must have such a world or field, something which is to them as matter, in the modern, not the scholastic sense, is to us. But if matter is to serve as a neutral field, it must have a fixed nature of its own. If a world or material system had only a single inhabitant, it might conform at every moment to his wishes. Trees, for his sake, would crowd into a shade. But if you were introduced into a world which thus varied at my every whim, you would be quite unable to act in it and would thus lose the exercise of your free will. Nor is it clear that you could make your presence known to me. All the matter by which you attempted to make signs to me being already in my control and therefore not capable of being manipulated by you. Again, if matter has a fixed nature and obeys constant laws, not all states of matter will be equally agreeable to the wishes of a given soul, nor all equally beneficial for that particular aggregate of matter which he calls his body. If fire comforts that body at a certain distance, it will destroy it when the distance is reduced. Hence, even in a perfect world, the necessity for those danger signals which the pain fibers in our nerves are apparently designed to transmit. Does this mean an inevitable element of evil in the form of pain in any possible world? I think not, for while it may be true that the least sin is an incalculable evil, the evil of pain depends upon degree, and pains below a certain intensity are not feared or resented at all. No one minds the process, warm, beautifully hot, too hot, it stings, which warns him to withdraw his hand from exposure to the fire. And if I may trust my own feeling, a slight aching in the legs as we climb into bed after a good day's walking is, in fact, pleasurable. Yet again, if the fixed nature of matter prevents it from being always and in all its dispositions equally agreeable even to a single soul, much less is it possible for the matter of the universe at any moment to be distributed so that it is equally convenient and pleasurable to each member of a society. If a man, travelling in one direction, is having a journey downhill, a man going in the opposite direction must be going uphill. If even a pebble lies where I want it to lie, it cannot, except by a coincidence, be where you want it to lie. And this is very far from being an evil. On the contrary, it furnishes occasion for all those acts of courtesy, respect, and unselfishness by which love and good humour and modesty express themselves. But it certainly leaves the way open to a great evil, that of competition and hostility. And if souls are free, they cannot be prevented from dealing with the problem by competition instead of courtesy. And once they have advanced to actual hostility, they can then exploit the fixed nature of matter to hurt one another. The permanent nature of wood, which enables us to use it as a beam, also enables us to use it for hitting our neighbour on the head. The permanent nature of matter in general means that when human beings fight, the victory ordinarily goes to those who have superior weapons, skill, and numbers, even if their cause is unjust. We can, perhaps, conceive of a world in which God corrected the results of this abuse of free will by his creatures at every moment, so that a wooden beam became as soft as grass when it was used as a weapon, and the air refused to obey me if I attempted to set up in it the sound waves that carry lies or insults. But such a world would be one in which wrong actions were impossible, and in which, therefore, freedom of the will would be void. Nay, if the principle were carried out to its logical conclusion, evil thoughts would be impossible, for the cerebral matter which we use in thinking would refuse its task when we attempted to frame them. All matter in the neighbourhood of a wicked man would be liable to undergo unpredictable alterations. That God can and does, on occasions, modify the behaviour of matter and produce what we call miracles is part of Christian faith. But the very conception of a common and therefore stable world demands that these occasions should be extremely rare. In a game of chess, you can make certain arbitrary concessions to your opponent, which stand to the ordinary rules of the game as miracles stand to the laws of nature. You can deprive yourself of a castle, or allow the other man sometimes to take back a move made inadvertently. But if you conceded everything that at any moment happened to suit him, if all his moves were revocable, and if all your pieces disappeared whenever their position on the board was not to his liking, then you could not have a game at all. So it is with the life of souls in a world. Fixed laws, consequences unfolding by causal necessity, the whole natural order are at once limits within which their common life is confined, and also the sole condition under which any such life is possible. Try to exclude the possibility of suffering, which the order of nature and the existence of free wills involve, and you find that you have excluded life itself. As I said before, this account of the intrinsic necessities of a world is meant merely as a specimen of what they might be. What they really are, only omniscience has the data and the wisdom to see. But they are not likely to be less complicated than I have suggested. Needless to say, complicated here refers solely to the human understanding of them. We are not to think of God arguing, as we do from an end, coexistence of free spirits, to the conditions involved in it, but rather of a single, utterly self-consistent act of creation, which to us appears, at first sight, as the creation of many independent things, and then as the creation of things mutually necessary. Even we can rise a little beyond the conception of mutual necessities as I have outlined it, can reduce matter as that which separates souls and matter, as that which brings them together under the single concept of plurality, whereof separation and togetherness are only two aspects. With every advance in our thought, the unity of the creative act and the impossibility of tinkering with the creation as though this or that element of it could have been removed will become more apparent. Perhaps this is not the best of all possible universes, but the only possible one. Possible worlds can mean only worlds that God could have made, but didn't. The idea of that which God could have done involves a too anthropomorphic conception of God's freedom. Whatever human freedom means, divine freedom cannot mean indeterminacy between alternatives and choice of one of them. Perfect goodness can never debate about the end to be attained, and perfect wisdom cannot debate about the means most suited to achieve it. The freedom of God consists in the fact that no cause other than himself produces his acts, and no external obstacle impedes them, that his own goodness is the root from which they all grow, and his own omnipotence the air in which they all flower. And that brings us to our next subject, the divine goodness. Nothing so far has been said of this, and no answer attempted to the objection that if the universe must, from the outset, admit the possibility of suffering, then absolute goodness would have left the universe uncreated. And I must warn the reader that I shall not attempt to prove that to create was better than not to create. I am aware of no human scales in which such a portentous question can be weighed. Some comparison between one state of being and another can be made, but the attempt to compare being and not being ends in mere words. It would be better for me not to exist. In what sense, for me? How should I, if I did not exist, profit by not existing? Our design is a less formidable one. It is only to discover how, perceiving a suffering world and being assured on quite different grounds that God is good, we are to conceive that goodness and that suffering without contradiction. 3. Divine goodness. Love can forbear, and love can forgive. But love can never be reconciled to an unlovely object. He can never therefore be reconciled to your sin, because sin itself is incapable of being altered. But he may be reconciled to your person, because that may be restored. Traherne, Centuries of Meditation. Any consideration of the goodness of God at once threatens us with the following dilemma. On the one hand, if God is wiser than we, his judgment must differ from ours on many things, and not least on good and evil. What seems to us good may therefore not be good in his eyes, and what seems to us evil may not be evil. On the other hand, if God's moral judgment differs from ours, so that our black may be his white, we can mean nothing by calling him good, for to say God is good, while asserting that his goodness is wholly other than ours, is really only to say God is we know not what. And an utterly unknown quality in God cannot give us moral grounds for loving or obeying him. If he is not, in our sense, good, we shall obey, if at all, only through fear, and should be equally ready to obey an omnipotent fiend. The doctrine of total depravity, when the consequence is drawn that since we are totally depraved, our idea of good is worth simply nothing, may thus turn Christianity into a form of devil worship. The escape from this dilemma depends on observing what happens, in human relations, when the man of inferior moral standards enters the society of those who are better and wiser than he, and gradually learns to accept their standards. A process which, as it happens, I can describe fairly accurately, since I have undergone it. When I came first to the university, I was as nearly without a moral conscience as a boy could be. Some faint distaste for cruelty and for meanness about money was my utmost reach. Of chastity, truthfulness, and self-sacrifice, I thought as a baboon thinks of classical music. By the mercy of God, I fell among a set of young men, none of them, by the way, Christians, who were sufficiently close to me in intellect and imagination to secure immediate intimacy, but who knew and tried to obey the moral law. Thus, their judgment of good and evil was very different from mine. Now, what happens in such a case is not in the least like being asked to treat as white what was hitherto called black. The new moral judgments never enter the mind as mere reversals, though they do reverse them, of previous judgments, but as lords that are certainly expected. You can have no doubt in which direction you are moving. They are more like good than the little shreds of good you already had, but are, in a sense, continuous with them. But the great test is that the recognition of the new standards is accompanied with a sense of shame and guilt. One is conscious of having blundered into society that one is unfit for. It is in the light of such experiences that we must consider the goodness of God. Beyond all doubt, his idea of goodness differs from ours. But you need have no fear that as you approach it, you will be asked simply to reverse your moral standards. When the relevant difference between the divine ethics and your own appears to you, you will not, in fact, be in any doubt that the change demanded of you is in the direction you already call better. The divine goodness differs from ours, but it is not sheerly different. It differs from ours not as white from black, but as a perfect circle from a child's first attempt to draw a wheel. But when the child has learned to draw, it will know that the circle it then makes is what it was trying to make from the very beginning. This doctrine is presupposed in Scripture. Christ calls men to repent, a call which would be meaningless if God's standards were sheerly different from that which they already knew and failed to practice. He appeals to our existing moral judgment. Why, even of yourselves, judge ye not what is right. God in the Old Testament expostulates with men on the basis of their own conceptions of gratitude, fidelity, and fair play, and puts himself, as it were, at the bar before his own creatures.